A history of comedy. It's Seven Old Jacks. A history of comedy.
Come and have a rummage in the archive.
A history of comedy. It's Seven Old Jacks. A history of comedy.
Come and have a rummage in the archive.
Hello, welcome to another episode of A History of Comedy in Several Objects, a podcast from the University of Kent about the British stand-up comedy archive, which exists to preserve all kinds of interesting material relating to stand-up comedy. Now, in this podcast, in each episode, we pick out one particular object from the stand-up comedy archive and talk about it in detail to reveal what it tells us about the nature of stand-up comedy. I'm Ollie Double, this is my colleague Elspeth Miller, and we are very much the Theodore and Eleanor Roosevelt of comedy archiving.
I know who they are, which is like the first time. I normally never know who they are.
Yeah.
I did American history, so like studied.
Also, it was one of the first ones I've done that's not actually comedians.
Yeah, I suppose they're not really a comedy double act.
I've just been going for any double acts. The only rules that I have is that there should be, like, there should definitely be one woman in the pairing, and it can be two women, because I think it's like potentially belittling to me to be he's just old Gert from Gert and Daisy kind of thing. But I don't want to belittle you. It's the short of it. Having said that, I need to come up with some more ideas. So if you have any thoughts, let me know. And we're very lucky in this episode to be joined by Bruce Dessau, the comedy critic from the Evening Standard, who also runs an excellent comedy website called Beyond the Joke. So do you want to tell us a little bit about your website?
Yes, thank you for plugging it. That's great. Well, the two sort of go together because, as you may have heard, newspapers have not been in the sort of healthiest state in recent years. And I felt at one point my space in the Evening Standard for covering comedy was sort of getting smaller and smaller. And I had so much I wanted to say about comedy that I had to find another outlet. And, yeah, I created my own website, Beyond the Joke. And, you know, the beauty of websites, and particularly when you run them, is you can write whatever you want as long as it's not libelous, I guess. And, you know, there's no word count. There's no limit on what you want to say about something. If you want to spout off endlessly, it might bore people, but at least you get the chance to say it. And I have to say, in fairness to the Standard, you know, it was a bit of a dip and then things picked up. And after I started the website, I then got more space in the Standard and we were able to cover a fair bit, certainly, you know, compared to other newspapers. But as I said, the one thing about the Standard is, you know, if you review a show, a West End, a London comedy show, you know, if you get more than 300 words, you're doing well. So it's, again, to have the luxury of being able to write at length about live comedy in particular, for the website is brilliant.
That's fantastic.
So you also provide news, so you've got your reviews,
in fact,
as well as other.
It's one of those interesting things. I sort of, you know, you sort of, it's a constant learning curve, websites, as I'm sure podcasts are as well. Mm. And when I set the website up, I thought, this is going to be a doddle. Every day I'm just going to get up in the morning, write 1,000 words about something about comedy that makes me angry. I'll just hit publish, go back to bed and let it see the hits pile up, and the website will be a huge success. And although occasionally those pieces do go viral and are very popular, firstly, it's quite hard to have a strong opinion about something every single day of the year. And secondly, I then realised that people actually, I'm not saying nobody does it, but there aren't many places you can get comedy news when big tours are announced, or when big TV series are announced, or when there is an incident at a comedy gig or something else happens. So I found actually the news section is very important. The news, you know, although the opinion pieces are widely read, actually the news pieces are extremely popular. And of course we review shows. So if I'm not reviewing something in the Standard and I want to review it, I'll review it for my website. And then after a decent interval, I will post the Evening Standard reviews on the website as well, and maybe adjust them and maybe contextualise them a bit more. Because also the other thing about the Standard is it's overnight reviews, where traditionally, you know, it's one of the few publications, in fact, where critics go straight off and write the review after seeing the show. So, you know, you are doing snap decisions and you know, writing very quickly for the Standard. So again, you know, it's something about when you've had a few days to consider things. You know, your opinions might even change. I mean, you won't go from saying have given something a rave review to giving it a negative review, but you might be a bit more considered about things.
That's really interesting. Now, that leads us very nicely into today's object. So, Elspeth, what have we got today?
So we're looking at, well, we've been looking at a variety of material. We should say, actually, that Bruce is our first get involved, really.
Bruce is our first get involved, because you wrote about the podcast on your website, and one of the things we're very keen to do is get people involved and come and take part in the podcast. So thank you for that. That's another reason to thank you for coming along.
Wow, thank you.
So we've been looking at material for about an hour, really, haven't we, from different collections, mainly Andy De La Torre's collection, Arnold Brown's collection, and Monica Babinska's collection. And so we've just chosen the object after looking at the material. And the object we have is a small review from Arnold Brown's collection, and it was within a folder of material that he had put together on the comic strip. So the kind of the collective, what do we call them, the collective?
I guess so.
A collective of performers, sort of in the early 80s. And this is a review, really, of one of their shows, which we think was published in the Evening Standard. It's been annotated as New Standard, but we think that's the Evening Standard, from March 81, written by Charles Spencer. And it's got a... He mainly talks about Alexei Sale. That's the sort of... I know we're going to read out some bits about it. He's mainly reviewing Alexei Sale, but does mention the other performers as well. And Arnold has kind of circled his bit.
Mm-hmm.
Which you see a lot in all the collections. You always get circled on the relevant, relevant bit.
I do that.
Yeah.
You know, if it was me, I would definitely pull around it. Perhaps with an arrow going towards it. And you said, oh, should we call them a collective? I think actually collective is quite suitable because, you know, at the time it was a time of sort of great sort of political idealism, even if the comic strip wasn't the most political wing of alternative comedy. So collective is one of those words that, you know, we're a kind of collective of. Actually, Tony Allen uses it in relation to alternative cabaret, which is a sort of rival faction, if you like, or rival group, I suppose.
Yeah, I think of alternative cabaret as a collective.
Mm. Yeah.
And they're often described in that way, aren't they? Or they were. Whereas
definitely.
I'm not sure how, if I've seen the comic strip described as a collective.
It sounds a bit Maoist to me. It should be a 5-year plan or something.
Yeah.
You should have
five-year plan for jokes. Mm. So I'll just quickly read a bit and then we'll talk about the article more generally. So this is, as Elspeth said, this is from the 31st of March 1981, and I'm going to read, it's a review of the comic strip show at the Raymond Review Bar. I'm going to read a few of the early paragraphs. A new generation of British comedians have forced their way past the bared breasts, phallic symbols and bewildered Japanese tourists to occupy the Review Bar's boulevard cabaret. The comic strip does for humour what Sex Pistols did for rock and roll. The ringleader of this inspired maniacal troupe, maybe that's what they should be called.
Sure.
This was inspired maniacal troupe is one Alexei Sale, who presides over the proceedings like a Liverpudlian Mephistopheles on speed. Mr. Sale is the kind of man you move nervously away from in a crowded public bar. He's fat, ugly, loud-mouthed, obscene, violent, scornful, and at times damn near berserk. He is also blissfully funny. And it goes on from there. And the acts it particularly mentions, it talks about the content of his act. The other acts it mentions are The Outer Limits, which was Peter Richardson and Nigel Planer's double act. And then at the end, Arnold Brown and French and Saunders.
Oh, and 20th Century Coyote.
Oh, 20th Century Coyote,
sorry,
it does, yes.
It's kind of covered by the red circle. So, and that was Rick Nail and Ade Edmondson.
Mm. Yes. So, Bruce, there's the article. I mean, you know, you're a comedy journalist.
Mm.
What do you make of this, seeing it now? I mean, there's a piece of comedy, of journalism about comedy from a long time ago.
Well, it's funny. I don't know if it's necessarily changed that much from this piece. I mean, I know Charles. He was more of a theatre critic in the 80s. I know him from the Telegraph. I think he sort of left a few years ago. And he's a very good writer, and he's a very perceptive writer, and very insightful writer. And he's introducing something new to readers, so he's, you know, got to come up with a few good descriptions of them. And, you know, the Liverpudlian Mephistopheles rings very true. It's a shame he wasn't from Manchester, because Mancunian Mephistopheles would have probably alliterated better. But... But actually, you know, I think he gives a good... And also, I should say, I don't know if I was actually at this particular gig, but I did go to the comic strip, and he does make me think of what it was like back then, and what these people that we think of as the comedy establishment or the comedy old guard now were actually like when they were younger. I'm quite impressed. I think the other thing, I'm trying to count how many words he's got. I bet this piece is larger than if I was reviewing something now. That's what I'm most jealous of. So,
can I double click on a couple of things there? First of all, you mentioned that you visited the comic strip as a punter. Mm. What do you remember about it?
Well, I went to the Comedy Store, which was the original one where you went up in the lift, and I do remember that as being very crowded, very anarchic. Keith Allen was as badly behaved as everyone says Keith Allen was. I don't remember him. He supposedly threw smashed glasses and things. He didn't do any of that on the night I was there. I don't know if he ever did do that, but he certainly was argumentative and would, you know, interact with the crowd and was very spontaneous. The comic strip, I remember it being, it was moving more towards theatre, although it was in one of the rooms in Paul Raymond's review bar, which was a strip club, as I think is mentioned in this review. It was still theatrical. It was still proper rows of seats, and it was like sitting in the stalls of a very small theatre. And I don't actually remember it being that crowded. I think I went on Saturday nights. I was a student at the time in London, and I think I went on Saturday nights. But we had a flyer or something from it, which in one of the archive, which was it four nights a week or something, and then two shows on Saturday night. So
this one,
yeah, you know, it was running so many nights, Tuesday to Sunday.
It's slightly confusing. So Tuesday to Sunday at 10 p.m. Yeah, and Friday and Saturday 8 p.m. and 10 p.m. Yeah. So it's a lot of shows.
And yet, interestingly, at the bottom there,
it does say only Fridays and Saturdays. Maybe I read this review, and maybe that's why I went on a Saturday, because, as I said, I do recall going on a Saturday night.
It could be that they started doing just a couple of nights a week and they grew to doing more, or it could be vice versa. They started, you know, doing lots and had to cut down.
Mm. I think the reason I went on a Saturday night was because it was a late, you were supposed to go to the late night show, and in those days there were only night buses on a Saturday night to get home, or Friday and Saturday with the only chance of getting home after midnight. So but it also because I went a few times, they did do the same material every time, you know, the routines that again crop up on the comic strip album, or things that 20th Century Coyote do that are famous because they've being on clips where Rick does his poem about Vanessa, or they do that joke about what's green and hairy and goes up and down a gooseberry in a lift. I've seen those lots, you know, they would do those every single week. And obviously, because they weren't on television back then, and they had it, apart from me, it was a different audience every week, they could do the same material. But I compare that to about a decade later, when I was first seeing Vic Reeves and Bob Mortimer do their early shows in the Albany in South London and Goldsmith's Tavern in South London. They would do a different show every week. Every Thursday night you'd go along, and they were on the dole. They didn't have anything else to do all week. You know, in those days, you know, if you were young, you got your rent paid, you could just sit around in a pub, and they wrote new material every week. So it changed a bit, but it was still a great atmosphere, the comic strip. I remember it very fondly.
In some ways, I think it was probably atypical, you know, in the sense that it was at the comedy store, or with alternative cabaret shows, or yeah, those kind of things. Yeah, there was at least a notion that people would write new material, and it was set up more like a stand-up night in the sense of somebody got up and compared. But this, because it was a fixed bill and the bill didn't change, I know they had guest acts on, but the central core of the bill remained the same. It was almost more like a review, possibly, than a stand-up night.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to double-click on was you mentioned that Charles Spencer was a theatre reviewer.
Mm.
We were speaking earlier about the idea. I mean, you are a comedy critic. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's your main thing.
Mm.
And the invention or the phenomenon of the comedy critic is comparatively recent, isn't it?
It's just almost this century. I guess I started in the last century, but it's kind of much more established. Yeah, the 1990s, I guess. And again, we were trying to sort of work out, I guess William Cook is the one that deserves a sort of a mention for sort of being someone who was the first sort of person known for writing about comedy and reviewing comedy. I'm not sure what his background, maybe he even came from a theatre background as well, thinking back to Was he at Time Out or City Limits as a theatre person? But again, someone like Malcolm Hay, who obviously deserves a lot of credit for popularising comedy when Malcolm was writing for Time Out. Malcolm, you know, came out of a theatrical back, you know, from writing about theatre and for theatre magazines.
Yeah, I'd say Malcolm was probably the very first, wasn't he? But that was in a listings magazine as opposed to a newspaper, yeah. Whereas William Cook wrote for The Guardian, and I think that was a big thing. And it wasn't like he was the first person to write about it. I mean, clearly there's people writing about it right from the beginning of the alternative comedy scene, as in this piece that we've been talking about. But in addition to that, there were people like Carol Sala used to write about the scene quite early in The Guardian and various other people. But I think the thing of being a named person who people know, oh, it's the William Cook review of this. Or you know, who do you think are the main comedy critics in the UK now? I mean, you'd be one of them.
Well, I wouldn't say me at all. But I guess it would be Dominic Maxwell at The Times, Dominic Cavendish at The Telegraph. But then it's interesting, they both also write about theatre. I mean, Dominic's Cavendish is the deputy theatre critic. He is the comedy critic as well, but he's also the deputy theatre critic of The Telegraph. And Dominic Maxwell shuttles between one and the other. But they, you know, they all write, and then when it's Edinburgh, well, until recent years, all the critics would go up to Edinburgh, and still The Times does, and I do, and you know, Edinburgh is when comedy becomes a full-time 24/7 job. Brian Logan of The Guardian, obviously,
who also comes from theatre.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then the person who I remember who doesn't really write so much about comedy now, but I feel comes from a similar background to myself, is Ben Thompson, who's written books about comedy, really written some very good books about comedy, and also and wrote regularly for The Independent, I think it was, or The Independent on Sunday. And like myself, Ben Thompson came from being a music journalist. So you've got this interesting sort of crisscross where you've got, you know, which again is how I feel comedy fits into culture, that it is somewhere between rock music or music and theatre.
Well, what's interesting about this review, of course, is it compares Alexei Sale with the Sex Pistols. That connection between alternative comedy and punk is one that's been made lots of times by lots of different people. And you can find direct factual links. But, I mean, I think beyond that, what's interesting is I think the vibe of comedy is at least as close to live music as it is to theatre. Because it's got that informality where the audience is expected to join in. They're allowed to shout things out. You can go and drink and watch the show. I know you can in theatres more now, but it has that feeling of informality and a direct connection between performer and audience much more than most theatre. So I mean, I think you know, the idea of somebody moving from music critic to comedy critic is in some ways a more natural fit than theatre critic to comedy critic.
Yeah, and I think very early on, I think maybe the music press, again, you've got some really interesting examples of that, but I think the music press picked up on the alternative comedy scene very quickly. In a way, maybe, you know, the broadsheets lagged behind in the way maybe they lagged behind with covering punk. You know, it was, again, to come, you know, coin all these cliches, you know, the alternative comedy scene, you know, was created on the streets, you know, literally, you know, on the streets in Soho. And that's kind of where, you know, the music press was based. And obviously some of the venues, again, you know, there's this overlap of the venues that when there weren't many comedy venues, they were the same venues that, you know, pub rock bands played, you'd get alternative comedians playing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Elgin in Ladbroke Grove was, you know, arguably, I mean, there is an argument to say it was the first alternative comedy venue, because the comedy store wasn't exactly an alternative comedy venue, at least it wasn't set up for that purpose. Whereas when, shortly after that, the comedy store opened, Alternative Cabaret started running their nights at the Elgin every week. That was set up for Alternative Cabaret. But yes, that was a pub which the 101ers used to have a residency at, Joe Strummer's pub rock band. So there's a, and, you know, Tony's street theatre group, Rough Theatre, did gigs with the 101ers. So there are actually direct factual links between the two.
I don't know what documentation you've got of it, but the other thing that occurs to me is, I think one example we mentioned before we started recording was John Cooper Clarke, but the gigs where you'd have bands supported by a comedian. A little bit later on, I remember seeing Dex's Midnight Runners, who did a gig at the Old Vic. It was famous because they banned alcohol. That's how I remember it. They wouldn't let the audience drink. But the support act was Keith Allen. He opened for Dexys Midnight Runners. And what's it? Norman Lovett says he opened for The Clash, I think. Norman Lovett played with The Clash. So it's interesting to get all these things to do. You don't hear so much about Norman Lovett opening for the RSC or Norman Lovett opening for, you know, something at the National Theatre. But when it was bands. So, yeah, so maybe the link is closer to music. Well, that's a fit.
I love the idea about Norman Lovett opening for The Clash because the energy of the two acts could not be more different. I mean, you know, Norman Lovett is famously slow and relaxed and very, very deadpan, as opposed to The Clash, who were sort of, particularly in their first album, like manic and sort of fast and loud and so on.
Maybe that's why they booked him, to make them look even faster, you know, after something so, the contrast was so great.
I mean, what would you say? I mean, when you're reviewing a comedy show, you know, for the readers of either your website or the Evening Standard, what do you think your job is?
Well, it's various things. Among them, and this is why, you know, I like this piece by Charles Spencer about the comic strip, because it is entertainingly written. It is, you know, it is funny to read, but it also is informs people of what's going on, and you know, it sells it. I mean, if I was the PR for the comic strip, I don't know if I had a PR in those days. I bought my tickets, but if I was the PR, I'd have been delighted by this piece because it really sells it as something you want to go and see. And I think as a critic, you know, you're doing a sort of consumer guide of saying whether something's good or bad, whether people should spend their money on buying tickets for it, you know, if it's a new show. And you want to be an entertaining writer. The difficulty about writing about comedy, which I think is different to writing about other art forms, is you're trying to be funny about something that's already funny. You know, if you're a critic writing about dance, then there's no humour necessarily in the dance, or if there is, the challenge is to convey it. And obviously the laziest possible way of being entertaining as a comedy critic is just to quote the jokes. And, you know, it has been said that that's sort of the sort of cardinal sin, that's the rule. I don't know where these rules have been written down anywhere, I've never seen them, but it's like the number one rule that you mustn't quote jokes. And I have to confess, I have done it, but I try and do it very, very sparingly. Partly because it doesn't, although, you know, a joke won't necessarily convey what was going on the night. You know, you're taking it out of context. If you don't know the act, it might not even make any sense. You know, there have been shows I've seen at the Edinburgh Festival. Even some, like, you know, Daniel Kitson, who I sort of generally, you know, he's quite widely regarded as the best comedian of his generation. I'm not sure if there are any jokes Daniel Kitson has told that would work in an Evening Standard review. So yes, if I do quote a joke, it's probably where it might be a joke that's quite well known anyway, so you're not sort of, for want of a better phrase, stealing their material, sort of piggybacking on their material. Or it might be someone like, say, Tim Vine, whose set is absolutely so peppered with gags that, you know, you're not going to spoil someone's fun if they've heard one of the gags before, if they go and see a Tim Vine show and they've read one of the jokes in your review.
Because each gag stands for itself and is a tiny percentage of the overall show.
I'd like, if it came to court, that's exactly a court case, that's exactly what I'd say. Whereas obviously what you mustn't do, and again, this has happened more with comedy actually becoming a little bit more theatrical in recent years, where a show has a narrative, you would no more want to give away the ending of the show than you would if you were, you know, spoilers in TV series or Game of Thrones or something. You know, you don't want to... You want to give a flavour of what the performance is like, and also a flavour of maybe what it's like to be there, to be at the show. Because, as you were saying, comedy is a bit more interactive, it's a bit more spontaneous than a theatre, an actual play would be. But... yeah, I've never seen any sort of written down rules of how to be a comedy critic, because it is such a new thing that I've sort of been very lucky that I've almost defined what it is as I've gone along.
I think we've got some other examples. What's this, Elspeth, that we've got over here?
So this is also from Arnold Brown's collection. It's a scrapbook that his sister put together, actually. A scrapbook full of press, basically. So running from the early 80s. From his time in the comic strip. Although this covers his... Because he was in the first night of the Comedy Store, so this article is talking about the Comedy Store. So, yeah, it's just full of full of press.
So this is an article, the page we've got this open is an article from the Observer magazine from 23rd of March 1980, making it the alternative comedy scene less than a year old at this point. And yeah, I mean, and then you go on through, you were mentioning the music press, there's a thing from the NME here, New Musical Express. We've got a flyer there from Pentameters, a largely forgotten early alternative comedy venue. Well, it's still there, it's a theatre club, isn't it?
I did tweet that image, actually, not that one, we've got another copy. And Nigel Plainer replied, and he had designed it. So that's nice.
That's very nice. Mm. Yeah, that is nice. This is from, I can't remember where this is from now, but this is from a newspaper magazine, like colour supplement. Mm. And it's covering the, I think it's the comic strip tour.
Mm.
So you've got journalists working on it, but it's just they're not comedy critics as such, because comedy, the modern phenomenon of live comedy is not established in the way it was before.
Mm.
What I find interesting about this piece, this our focus episode, the episode, is it's probably something that sounds a bit silly, but so it's cut out of a newspaper, so we haven't got the whole page.
Yeah,
I find this interesting. Yeah. It's captured as humour, and then so that's the section of the paper is the humour section, and I've never seen that anywhere else. It's always cabaret and then comedy. Mm. And I've just never seen that. And
it's a really good point.
It's just quite interesting. I don't know if that's an Evening Standard thing and we need to find some more Evening Standard
pieces. I wonder
when it changed,
because it's always been comedy. Although, again, I have a slightly roving brief, so I also cover circus. Oh. And that will be billed as circus. Okay. And occasionally, I think something like Kiss and the Widow I would have done, and I think I might have said to them, we should call it cabaret. So we do call things cabaret sometimes, but yeah, we don't ever call things stand-up comedy. We always just call them comedy, and it kind of is a sort of big umbrella term.
But it was listed as cabaret in lots of publications for a long time after the circuit started, and those terms, alternative cabaret and alternative comedy, were pretty interchangeable in the early.
So when did they change? How? What was?
Well,
the
they were simultaneous. That's the thing. Mm. And it's also confusing. We've mentioned this in an earlier episode, but alternative cabaret with capital A, capital C, was a specific group as well. Mm. So it's quite difficult to pin down, I'm always a bit allergic to try and find the earliest possible usage of something, because there's always a potential one you don't know about. But they don't start being used for about the first year or so, I think, those terms, except obviously in relation to alternative cabaret the group. So we keep going through this scrapbook. It's really from a variety of different sources here, but many of them are either newspapers or local newspapers or music papers. That's quite good. There's a photo story there. There's something stuck to it. Unfortunately, we can't quite see it. But they've done, one of those things with, like, a comic strip with photos. And there's another music press one. Sounds was one of the big music papers. And that's Arnold Brown when he got the Perry Award in 87. So, looking through this stuff, I mean, does it look familiar to you? Is this the sort of thing that you would cover? I mean, and are the things that stand out for you as a comedy critic?
Well, it makes me all very misty-eyed for that era. I was more of back in the 80s, I was a fan, really. It's interesting that they're features. And again, you've got a few reviews in there, like this Evening Standard review. But mainly it was being covered, looking at these pieces anyway, as features. You know, the colour supplements liked it because it was young, kind of, I wouldn't say good-looking people, but young people, a few women as well. We've got to remember French and Saunders are featured in some of these features. There were women in them as well, in the groups as well.
Pauline Melville from Alternative Cabaret, and Maggie Steed.
So it was kind of, being profiled as a phenomenon, and the people were being interviewed, all this stuff about how Arnold Brown gave up a thriving career in accountancy to be a stand-up comedian. But maybe there aren't that many examples. In fact, I was just looking at the one that came up with the other. There aren't that many examples of actual reviews. And the one that, I saw earlier on was from the NME. And it was the NME rather than a national newspaper.
Yes.
And it was written by Andy Gill, who is, currently the, rock critic on The Independent, or was last time I saw The Independent. So there weren't the critics there. But also, I don't know, how many shows were being reviewed in the 80s. I guess when you get those big tours, I think we saw some stuff about Rick Mayall's tour that would have been reviewed, because it was, you know, and comedy was big. You know, Rick Mayall, when he toured, was playing, as it was back then, the Hammersmith Odeon, or as it is now, the Aventim Apollo, however you, not sure how you say that word, the something or other Apollo. But they weren't necessarily reviewed, which is ironic, because papers had lots of space in those days. You know, they had the budgets to employ people, they had the writers.
But also, taking it back a bit further, I mean, you can go back through digital archives of newspapers and find reviews of comedians going right back to the music hall. So late 19th century, you can find reviews of Little Titch, say, in the Manchester Guardian. So the idea of reviewing comedy, just, I suppose one of the things is comedy is sort of seen as low culture, and you'd think that respectable newspapers would be above reviewing it, you know, when they're perhaps still snobby enough to have that attitude. But actually, no, you can go back and find reviews of people like Little Titch. But what's different now is this thing of going, well, comedy's important enough to have a dedicated reviewer. And I suppose then it becomes a thing where you're known for your particular tastes and attitudes.
Well, that's, and I don't know where the turning point was. I suppose it was around that whole comedy is the new rock and roll thing, you know, Bedil and Newman. In fact, I remember being at that Bedil and Newman gig at Wembley Arena, which was, they say, the first comedy show in an arena in this country. I think it was 93, something like that. I'm pretty sure it was 93.
Yeah.
And I do remember I can't remember who I was writing, but I was reviewing it for somebody, and Charles Spencer, now I come to think of it, was reviewing it for whoever he was writing for in 93, probably The Telegraph. And I do remember the show started late, and Charles Spencer getting very irate that the show was starting late. And again, I think that's because he was used to theatre shows where, you know, if it says 7:30 in the programme, it starts at 7:30. And I was used to going to gigs at the Camden Palace or the Music Machine or the Marquee, and you just stood around for hours waiting for the bands to come on. So we both kind of came at it from a different direction. But maybe I'm being unfair. Maybe he just had to file an overnight review, and he just was worried that he was going to miss his deadline. But maybe it was around then that, you know, editors and commissioning editors thought, there's more comedy on, we should cover more comedy. But the other thing that's changed recently, and I think, again, this kind of cropped up when we were looking at some of the early things that Malcolm Hay was writing for Time Out, was comedy now, the shows that I review for the Evening Standard, a huge generalisation, but quite a lot of them tend to be shows that have come down from Edinburgh and are on at the Soho Theatre for 10 nights. So they're proper one-person shows that run for an hour. And there weren't that many of those shows back in the 80s. You know, these reviews that we found, this Charles Spencer thing, it's kind of the equivalent of a club gig, or as you said, a review bill. There's lots of people on it doing what would probably only been 15-minute, at the most, sets. And I don't really, certainly for the Evening Standard, I don't really review those shows now. I mean, often comedians don't want me to review them when they're doing club shows, because what they're doing then is developing material that they might be planning to turn into the award-winning one-hour show in Edinburgh. So, funnily enough, having said lots of stuff about how comedy is so similar to rock and roll, I'm now completely turning that theory on its head and saying comedy at the moment is very similar to theatre, that these are shows at the Soho Theatre. They're billed to start at 8 o'clock. You get there at 8 o'clock and you sit and you watch the show for an hour. A theatre show.
I mean, we have material relating to Edinburgh stuff from the very early days of this type of comedy going up to Edinburgh. And actually, it's so different. I mean, I think the standard hour set wasn't a thing. I mean, even when Arnold Brown won, he won for Brown Blues, where I think it was him and Younger and Parker. And I think that their slot wasn't even an hour. It was a different length. It was maybe a bit over an hour, but shared between the two of them. But I mean, going back to when Alternative Cabaret first went up in 81, I think, they had a slot longer than an hour, and there were a bunch of them going up, and they made money, right? So things have changed a lot, and I think that modern conceptual show is something that it has particularly become important in the last 10 or 12 years,
yeah.
Where stand-up's gone more to the theatrical end.
I suppose
the one thing that's worth saying is, if you're saying that you think that the comedy critic became a more sort of prominent thing about the time of Badil and Newman, I mean, in a way, Badil and Newman doing the first UK stadium comedy gig was in 93, was like a moment of something starting, being very punk, DIY, you know, hand to mouth. Like, nobody got paid except Alexei Sale, none of the acts anyway, when the comedy store started. You know, and it was very much a sort of, you know, a scene that was being brought by people's passion as opposed to a sort of career plan or whatever. And then it became more and more commercial and professional. And I think in a way that was the first high watermark of that commercial success. Like, now this type of comedy is something we can do in an arena. And I think that I certainly think that what's significant about our item for today, this Charles Spencer review of the comic strip from 81, is that, you know, this was the beginning of comedy being taking itself more seriously, I suppose, as an art form. And one of the logical conclusions of that is that you'll get somebody like you who is actually professionally, you know, able to critique this stuff for a living.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of, you know, it's becoming part of, I suppose it's the first sign of it becoming part of the establishment as well, and, you know, becoming, you know, a bit more fixed, a bit more kind of a permanence to it, rather than something that might have come 1 year and might have closed down a year later. It's kind of, that review in the Standard back then is a sort of, you know, an antecedent of what I'm doing in the Standard now, what, 36 years later. So it's... I mean, they need, you know, it's it is an, you know, again, it's a whole different podcast to discuss about whether comedy is an art form. But I think we can both agree it is an art form. And as such, it needs to be taken seriously in the same way people will take dance seriously, or theatre, or sculpture, or any of those other things, you know, jazz or something, you know, it's jazz or rock and roll, things that are on the outside, come in from the cold, come in from the outside, and then get taken seriously.
Interestingly, I mean, I referenced Little Titch earlier. He wrote a piece where he was very unhappy at the lowly, you know, esteem in which music hall comedians were held in comparison to actors. And he talked about the fact that George Robey got knighted not for his music hall work but for his war work. and he made a passionate case that they were at least as good artists as actors. And that's, you know, you going back probably over 100 years when he wrote that. But I agree. I think it is an art form, and I think that what comedians do is kind of extraordinary. And I think you can't do comedy without an audience, and without critics it's hard to get an audience, so there's a sort of symbiotic relationship in a way.
Well, the other thing is, I think it's as funny as we were pointing out in this review how Arnold, or maybe his sister, has ringed around his little paragraph, or his two sentences, because there's a kind of ambivalence that they don't want to be ignored, but sometimes they don't like the attention either. They don't like what we say. But, you know, it's the old Oscar Wilde thing, isn't it? They'd rather have something bad written about them than have nothing written about them at all, you know, than be completely ignored. I think generally they sort of like the attention. And, you know, you get these comedians who say, oh, I never read my reviews. And yet, you know, when they've had a few drinks, they can quote the reviews word for word at you late at night, so...
Okay, well, this podcast isn't just about us talking to you. It's also about you getting involved, and there are various different ways you can do that.
Get involved!
There are many ways you can get involved with this podcast, but first you'll need to know how to contact us. You can email us at standup, all in one word, no hyphen, at kent.ac.uk. Or you can contact us via Twitter. Our Twitter handle is HistComPod, all in one word, or we're also on Facebook. And the first way you can get involved is to go onto our online catalogue, find a listing for a comedy object and nominate it, and we'll talk about nominated objects in future episodes. That's the vanilla version.
The chocolate chip version is to arrange to come into the Stand Up Comedy Archive, look at material for yourself, and then record a short piece about the object, and we'll feature it as in one of our future episodes.
And the stupidest way of getting involved is listen to our theme tune, record your own cover version of it, send it in, and if we like it, we'll use it in a future episode.
If we like it. I like that.
Anyway, that's the end of this episode. We'll see you next time for another thrilling instalment of A History of Comedy in Several Objects.
A History of Comedy in Several Objects is devised and presented by Dr. Oliver Double and Elspeth Miller for the British Stand-Up Comedy Archive, brought to you by the University of Kent. This is made possible by the University of Kent's Public Engagement Research Fund. Photography by Matt Wilson, and editing and production by Matt Hulse.